Chapter 6. Early in the morning, enjoying the cool, bright sunlight, Mrs. Juliana Frink did her grocery shopping. She strolled along the sidewalk, carrying the two brown paper bags, halting at each store to study the window displays. She took her time. Wasn't there something she was supposed to pick up at the drugstore? She wandered in. Her shift at the judo parlor did not begin until noon. This was her free time today. Seating herself on a stool at the counter, she put down her shopping bags and began to go over the different magazines. The new Life, she saw, had a big article called Television in Europe, Glimpse of Tomorrow. Turning to it, interested, she saw a picture of a German family watching television in their living room. Already, the article said, there was 4 hours of image broadcast during the day from Berlin. Someday there would be television stations in all the major European cities. And by 1970, one would be built in New York. The article showed Reich electronic engineers at the New York site helping the local personnel with their problems. It was easy to tell which were the Germans. They had that healthy, clean, energetic, assured look. The Americans, on the other hand, they just looked like people. They could have been anybody. One of the German technicians could be seen pointing off somewhere, and the Americans were trying to make out what he was pointing at. I guess their eyesight is better than ours, she decided. Better diet over the last 20 years. As we've been told, they can see things no one else can. Vitamin A, perhaps? I wonder what it's like to sit home in your living room and see the whole world on a little gray glass tube. If those Nazis can fly back and forth between here and Mars, why can't they get television going? I think I'd prefer that, to watch those comedy shows, actually see what Bob Hope and Durante look like, than to walk around on Mars. Maybe that's it, she thought as she put the magazine back on the rack. The Nazis have no sense of humor, so why should they want television? Anyhow, they killed most of the really great comedians, because most of them were Jewish. In fact, she realized, they killed off most of the entertainment field. I wonder how Hope gets away with what he says. Of course, he has to broadcast from Canada, and it's a little freer up there. But Hope really says things, like the joke about Goring, the one where Goring buys Rome and has it shipped to his mountain retreat and then set up again, and revives Christianity so his pet lions will have something to...
Did you want to buy that magazine, miss?
The little dried-up old man who ran the drugstore called, with suspicion. Guiltily, she put down the Reader's Digest, which she had begun to thumb through. Again strolling along the sidewalk with her shopping bags, Juliana thought, maybe Goring will be the new Führer when that Bormann dies. He seems sort of different from the others. The only way that Bormann got it in the first place was to weasel in when Hitler realized how fast he was going. Old Goring was off in his mountain palace. Goring should have been Führer after Hitler, because it was his Luftwaffe that knocked out those English radar stations and then finished off the RAF. Hitler would have had them bomb London, like they did Rotterdam. But probably Goebbels will get it, she decided. That was what everyone said. As long as that awful Heydrich doesn't, he'd kill us all. He's really bats. The one I like, she thought, is that Balder von Schirach. He's the only one who looks normal, anyhow, but he hasn't got a chance. Turning, she ascended the steps to the front door of the old wooden building in which she lived. When she unlocked the door of her apartment, she saw Joe Cinadella still lying where she had left him, in the center of the bed, on his stomach, his arms dangling. He was still asleep. No, she thought, he can't still be here. The truck's gone. Did he miss it? Obviously. Going into the kitchen, she set her grocery bags on the table among the breakfast dishes. But did he intend to miss it? She asked herself. That's what I wonder. What a peculiar man. He had been so active with her, going on almost all night. And yet it had been as if he were not actually there, doing it but never being aware. Thoughts on something else, maybe. From habit, she began putting food away in the old GE turret-top refrigerator, and then she began clearing the breakfast table. Maybe he's done it so much, she decided. It's second nature. His body makes the motions, like mine now as I put these plates and silver in the sink. Could do it with 3/5 of his brain removed, like the leg of a frog in biology class. Hey, she called. Wake up. In the bed, Joe stirred, snorted. Did you hear the Bob Hope show the other night? She called. He told this really funny joke, the one where his German major is interviewing some Martians. The Martians can't provide racial documentation about their grandparents being Aryan, you know, so the German major reports back to Berlin that Mars is populated by Jews. Coming into the living room where Joe lay in the bed, she said, "And they're about 1 foot tall and have two heads. You know how Bob Hope goes on." Joe had opened his eyes. He said nothing. He stared at her unwinkingly. His chin, black with stubble, his dark, ache-filled eyes. She also became quiet then.
"What is it?"
she said at last. "Are you afraid?" No, she thought. That's Frank who's afraid. This is... I don't know what.
"The rig went on," Joe said, sitting up.
"What are you going to do?"
She seated herself on the edge of the bed, drying her arms and hands with the dish towel.
"I'll catch him on the return. He won't say anything to anybody. He knows I'll do the same for him."
"You've done this before?"
she asked. Joe did not answer. "You meant to miss it," Juliana said to herself. "I can tell. All at once I know."
"Suppose he takes another route back," she said.
"He always would take 50, never 40. He had an accident on the 40 once. Some horses got out in the road, and he plowed into them, in the Rockies."
Picking up his clothes from the chair, he began to dress.
"How old are you, Joe?"
she asked as she contemplated his naked body.
34.
Then, she thought, you must have been in the war. She saw no obvious physical defects. He had, in fact, quite a good, lean body with long legs. Joe, seeing her scrutiny, scowled and turned away.
"Can't I watch?"
she asked, wondering why not. All night with him, and then this modesty.
"Are we bugs?" she said. "We can't stand the sight of each other in the daylight. We have to squeeze into the walls."
Grunting sourly, he started toward the bathroom in his underpants and socks, rubbing his chin.
"This is my home," Juliana thought. "I'm letting you stay here, and yet you won't allow me to look at you? Why do you want to stay, then?"
She followed after him into the bathroom. He had begun running hot water in the bowl to shave. On his arm she saw a tattoo, a blue letter C.
"What's that?"
she asked.
"Your wife? Connie? Corinne?"
Joe, washing his face, said, "Cairo." What an exotic name, she thought with envy, and then she felt herself flush.
"I'm really stupid,"
she said. An Italian, 34 years old, from the Nazi part of the world, he had been in the war all right, but on the Axis side, and he had fought at Cairo. The tattoo was their bond, the German and Italian veterans of that campaign, the defeat of the British and Australian army under General Gott at the hands of Rommel and his Africa Corps. She left the bathroom, returned to the living room, and began making the bed. Her hands flew. In a neat stack on the chair lay Joe's possessions, clothes, and small suitcase, personal articles. Among them she noticed a velvet-covered box, a little like a glasses case. Picking it up, she opened it and peeked inside. "You certainly did fight at Cairo," she thought, as she gazed down at the Iron Cross Second Class with the word and the date, June 10, 1945, engraved at its top. "They didn't all get this, only the valiant ones. I wonder what you did. You were only 17 years old then." Joe appeared at the door of the bathroom just as she lifted the medal from its velvet box. She became aware of him and jumped guiltily. But he did not seem angry.
"I was just looking at it," Juliana said. "I've never seen one before. Did Rommel pin it on you himself?"
"General Beyerland gave them out. Rommel had already been transferred to England to finish up there."
His voice was calm, but his hand once more had begun the monotonous pawing at his forehead, fingers digging into his scalp in that combing motion which seemed to be a chronic nervous tic.
"Would you tell me about it?"
Juliana asked, as he returned to the bathroom and his shaving. As he shaved, and after that took a long hot shower, Joe Cinadella told her a little, nothing like the sort of account she would have liked to hear. His two older brothers had served in the Ethiopian campaign, while he, at 13, had been in a fascist youth organization in Milan, his hometown. Later, his brothers had joined a crack artillery battery, that of Major Ricardo Pardi, and when World War II began, Joe had been able to join them. They had fought under Graziani. Their equipment, especially their tanks, had been dreadful. The British had shot them down, even senior officers, like rabbits. Doors of the tanks had to be held shut with sandbags during battle to keep them from flying open. Major Pardi, however, had reclaimed discarded artillery shells, polished and greased them, and fired them.
His battery had halted General Revelle's great desperate tank advance in 43.
"Are your brothers still alive?" Juliana asked.
His brothers had been killed in 44, strangled with wire by British commandos, the long-range desert group which had operated behind Axis lines and which had become especially fanatic during the last phases of the war when it was clear that the Allies could not win.
"How do you feel about the British now?" she asked haltingly.
Joe said, "I'd like to see them do to England what they did in Africa."
His tone was flat.
"But it's been 18 years, Juliana said. "I know the British especially did terrible things, but..."
"They talk about the things the Nazis did to the Jews," Joe said. "The British have done worse. In the Battle of London..."
He became silent.
"Those fire weapons, phosphorus and oil. I saw a few of the German troops afterward. Boat after boat burned to a cinder. Those pipes under the water turned the sea to fire. And on civilian populations by those mass firebombing raids that Churchill thought were going to save the war at the last moment. Those terror attacks on Hamburg and Essen and..."
"Let's not talk about it," Juliana said.
In the kitchen, she started cooking bacon. She turned on the small white plastic Emerson radio which Frank had given her on her birthday.
"I'll fix you something to eat."
She dialed, trying to find some light, pleasant music.
"Look at this," Joe said.
In the living room, he sat on the bed, his small suitcase beside him. He had opened it and brought out a ragged, bent book, which showed signs of much handling. He grinned at Juliana.
"Come here. You know what somebody says? This man..." He indicated the book. "This is very funny. Sit down."
He took hold of her arm, drew her down beside him.
"I want to read to you. Suppose they had won. What would it be like? We don't have to worry. This man has done all the thinking for us."
Opening the book, Joe began turning pages slowly.
"The British Empire would control all Europe, all the Mediterranean, no Italy at all, no Germany either. Bobbies and those funny little soldiers in tall fur hats, and the king as far as the Volga."
In a low voice, Juliana said,
"Would that be so bad?"
"You read the book?"
"No,"
she admitted, peering to see the cover. She had heard about it, though. A lot of people were reading it.
"But Frank and I, my former husband and I, often talked about how it would have been if the Allies had won the war."
Joe did not seem to hear her. He was staring down at the copy of The Grasshopper Lies Heavy.
"And in this," he went on, "you know how it is that England wins, beats the Axis?"
She shook her head, feeling the growing tension of the man beside her. His chin now had begun to quiver. He licked his lips again and again, dug at his scalp. When he spoke, his voice was hoarse.
"He has Italy betray the Axis," Joe said.
"Oh," she said.
"Italy goes over to the Allies, joins the Anglo-Saxons, and opens up what he calls the softer underbelly of Europe. But that's natural for him to think of that. We all know the cowardly Italian army that ran every time they saw the British drinking vino. Happy-go-lucky, not made for fighting. This fellow..."
Joe closed the book, turned it around to study the back cover.
"Abenson. I don't blame him. He writes of this fantasy, imagines how the world would be if the Axis had lost. How else could they lose except by Italy being a traitor?"
His voice grated.
"The Duce. He was a clown. We all know that."
"I have to turn the bacon."
She slid away from him and hurried back to the kitchen. Following after her, still carrying the book, Joe went on.
"And the U.S. comes in after it licks the Japs. And after the war, the U.S. and Britain divide the world, exactly like Germany and Japan did in reality."
Juliana said,
"Germany, Japan, and Italy."
He stared at her.
"You left out Italy."
She faced him calmly. "Did you forget, too?" she said to herself. "Like everybody else? The little empire in the Middle East? The musical comedy, New Rome?" Presently she served him a platter of bacon and eggs, toast and marmalade, coffee. He ate readily. "What did they serve you in North Africa?" she asked, as she too seated herself. Joe said,
"Dead donkey."
That's hideous. With a twisted grin, Joe said,
Asino Morte. The bully beef cans had the initials A.M. stamped on them. The Germans called it Altermann, old man.
He resumed his rapid eating. I would like to read this, Juliana thought as she reached to take the book from under Joe's arm. Will he be here that long? The book had grease on it. Pages were torn. Finger marks all over it. Read by truck drivers on the long haul, she thought. In the one-armed beaneries late at night. I'll bet you're a slow reader, she thought. I'll bet you've been poring over this book for weeks, if not months. Opening the book at random, she read, Now in his old age, he viewed tranquility, domains such as the ancients would have coveted but not comprehended, ships from the Crimea to Madrid, and all the empire, all with the same coin, speech, flag. The great old Union Jack dipping from sunrise to sunset. It had been fulfilled at last, that about the sun and the flag.
The only book I carry around, Juliana said, isn't actually a book. It's the Oracle, the I Ching. Frank got me hooked on it, and I use it all the time to decide. I never let it out of my sight, ever.
She closed the copy of The Grasshopper.
Want to see it? Want to use it?
No, Joe said. Resting her chin on her folded arms on the table surface and gazing at him sideways, she said,
Have you moved in here permanently? And what are you up to?
Brooding over the insults, the slanders. You petrify me, she thought, with your hatred of life. But you have something. You're like a little animal, not important, but smart. Studying his limited, clever, dark face, she thought, How could I ever have imagined you as younger than me? But even that's true, your childishness. You are still the baby brother, worshipping your two older brothers and your major party and General Rommel, panting and sweating to break loose and get the Tommies. Do they actually garrote your brothers with loops of wire? We heard that, the atrocity stories and photos released after the war. She shuddered. But the British commandos were brought to trial and punished long ago. The radio had ceased playing music. There seemed to be a news program, racket of shortwave from Europe. The voice faded and became garbled. A long pause, nothing at all, just silence. Then the Denver announcer, very clear, close by. She reached to turn the dial, but Joe stopped her hand.
News of Chancellor Bormann's death shocked a stunned Germany, which had been assured as recently as yesterday.
She and Joe jumped to their feet.
All Reich stations canceled scheduled programs, and listeners heard the solemn strains of the chorus of the SS Division Das Reich, raised in the anthem of the Partei, the Horst Wessel Lied. Later, in Dresden, where the acting Partei secretary and chiefs of Sicherheitsdienst, the National Security Police, which replaced the Gestapo following...
Joe turned the volume up.
Reorganization of the government at the instigation of the late Reichsfuhrer Himmler, Albert Speer, and others, 2 weeks of official mourning were declared, and already many shops and businesses have closed, it was reported. As yet, no word has come as to the expected convening of the Reichstag, the formal parliament of the Third Reich, whose approval is required.
It'll be Heydrich, Joe said.
I wish it would be that big blonde fellow, that Schirach, she said. Christ, so he finally died. Do you think Schirach has a chance?
No, Joe said shortly.
Maybe there'll be a civil war now, she said. But those guys are so old now, Goring and Goebbels, all those old party boys.
The radio was saying,
Reached at his retreat in the Alps near Brenner.
Joe said,
This'll be Fath Herman.
Said merely that he was grief-stricken by the loss, not only of a soldier and patriot and faithful Partei leader, but also, as he has said many times over, of a personal friend, whom, one will recall, he backed in the interregnum dispute shortly after the war, when it appeared for a time that elements hostile to Herr Bormann's ascension to supreme authority...
Juliana shut the radio off.
They're just babbling, she said. Why do they use words like that? Those terrible murderers are talked about as if they were like the rest of us.
They are like us, Joe said.
He reseated himself and once more ate.
There isn't anything that they've done we wouldn't have done if we'd been in their places. They saved the world from a communism. We'd be living under red rule now if it wasn't for Germany. We'd be worse off.
You're just talking, Juliana said. Like the radio, babbling.
I've been living under the Nazis, Joe said. I know what it's like. Is that just talk, to live 12, 13 years? Longer than that, almost 15 years? I got a work card from OT. I worked for Organization Talks since 1947, in North Africa and the USA. Listen, he jabbed his finger at her. I got the Italian genius for earthworks. OT gave me a high rating. I wasn't shoveling asphalt and mixing concrete for the autobahns. I was helping design, engineer. One day Dr. Toth came by and inspected what our work crew did. He said to me, "You got good hands. That's a big moment, Juliana. Dignity of labor. They're not talking only words." Before them, the Nazis, everyone looked down on the manual jobs, myself too, aristocratic. The labor front put an end to that. I seen my own hands for the first time. He spoke so swiftly that his accent began to take over. She had trouble understanding him. "We all lived out there in the woods in upper state New York like brothers, sang songs, marched to work, spirit of the war, only rebuilding, not breaking down. Those were the best days of all, rebuilding after the war. Fine, clean, long-lasting rows of public buildings block by block, whole new downtown, New York and Baltimore. Now, of course, that world's past. Big cartels like a New Jersey Krupp and Sonnen running the show. But that's not Nazi. That's just old European powerful. Worse, are you here? Nazis like Rommel and Todt, a million times better men than industrious like Krupp and bankers. All those Prussians ought to have been gassed. All those gentlemen in vests." But, Juliana thought, those gentlemen in vests are in forever. And your idols, Rommel and Dr. Todt, they just came in after hostilities to clear the rubble, build the autobahns, start industry humming. They even let the Jews live. Lucky surprise. Amnesty so the Jews could pitch in. Until 49, anyhow. And then goodbye Tott and Rommel, retired to graze. Don't I know, Juliana thought. Didn't I hear all about it from Frank? You can't tell me anything about life under the Nazis. My husband is a Jew. I know that Dr. Tott was the most modest gentleman that ever lived. I know all he wanted to do was provide work, honest, reputable work, for the millions of bleak-eyed, despairing American men and women picking through the ruins after the war. I know he wanted to see medical plans, vacation resorts, and adequate housing for everyone, regardless of race. He was a builder, not a thinker. And in most cases, he managed to create what he had wanted. He actually got it. But a preoccupation in the back of her mind now rose decidedly.
"Joe, this Grasshopper book, isn't it banned on the East Coast?"
He nodded.
"How could you be reading it, then?"
Something about it worried her.
"Don't they still shoot people for reading?"
"It depends on your racial group, on the good old armband." That was so. Slavs, Poles, Puerto Ricans were the most limited as to what they could read, do, listen to. The Anglo-Saxons had it much better. There was public education for their children, and they could go to libraries and museums and concerts. But even so, the Grasshopper was not merely classified. It was forbidden, and to everyone. Joe said, "I read it in the toilet. I hid it in a pillow. In fact, I read it because it was a band."
"You're very brave," she said.
Doubtfully, he said, "You mean that sarcastically?"
"No."
He relaxed a little. "It's easy for you people here. You live a safe, purposeless life, nothing to do, nothing to worry about. Out of the stream of events, left over from the past, right?" His eyes mocked her.
"You're killing yourself," she said, "with cynicism. Your idols got taken away from you one by one, and now you have nothing to give your love to."
She held his fork toward him. He accepted it. "Eat," she thought, "or give up even the biological processes." As he ate, Joe nodded at the book and said, "That Abinson lives around here, according to the cover. In Cheyenne. Guess perspective on the world from such a safe spot, wouldn't you guess? Read what it says. Read it aloud." Taking the book, she read the back part of the jacket. "He's an ex-serviceman. He was in the U.S. Marine Corps in World War II, wounded in England by a Nazi Tiger tank. A sergeant. It says he's got practically a fortress that he writes in. Guns all over the place." Setting the book down, she said, "And it doesn't say so here, but I heard someone say that he's almost a sort of paranoid. Charged barbed wire around the place, and it's set in the mountains. Hard to get to."
"Maybe he's right," Joe said, "to live like that after writing that book. The German bigwigs hit the roof when they read it."
"He was living that way before. He wrote the book there. His place is called," she glanced at the book jacket, "The High Castle. That's his pet name for it.
They won't get him, Joe said, chewing rapidly. He's on the lookout. Smart.
She said, I believe he's got a lot of courage to write that book. If the Axis had lost the war, we'd be able to say and write anything we wanted, like we used to. We'd be one country, and we'd have a fair legal system, the same one for all of us.
To her surprise, he nodded reasonably to that.
I don't understand you, she said. What do you believe? What is it you want? You defend those monsters, those freaks who slaughtered the Jews, and then you...
Despairing, she caught hold of him by the ears. He blinked in surprise and pain as she rose to her feet, tugging him up with her. They faced each other, wheezing, neither able to speak.
Let me finish this meal you fixed for me, Joe said at last.
Won't you say?
You won't tell me? You do know what it is yourself. You understand, and you just go on eating, pretending you don't have any idea what I mean.
She let go of his ears. They had been twisted until they were now bright red.
Empathy talk, Joe said. It doesn't matter. Like the radio, what you said of it. You know the old brown shirt term for people who spin philosophy? Eierkopf. Egghead. Because the big double-domed empty heads break so easily in the street brawls.
If you feel like that about me, Juliana said, why don't you go on? What are you staying here for?
His enigmatic grimace chilled her. I wish I had never let him come with me, she thought. And now it's too late. I know I can't get rid of him. He's too strong. Something terrible is happening, she thought, coming out of him, and I seem to be helping it.
What's the matter?
He reached out, chucked her beneath the chin, stroked her neck, put his fingers under her shirt and pressed her shoulders affectionately.
A mood. Your problem. I'll analyze you free.
They'll call you a Jew analyst, she smiled feebly. Do you want to wind up in an oven?
You're scared of the men, right?
I don't know.
It was possible to tell last night, only because I...
He cut his sentence off.
Because I took special care to notice your wants.
Because you've gone to bed with so many girls, Juliana said. That's what you started to say.
But I know I'm right. Listen, I'll never hurt you, Juliana. On my mother's body, I give you my word. I'll be specially considerate. And if you want to make an issue out of my experience, I'll give you the advantage of that. You'll lose your jitters. I can relax you and improve you. In not very much time, either. You've just had bad luck.
She nodded, cheered a bit. But she still felt cold and sad, and she still did not know quite why. To begin his day, Mr. Nobusuke Togomi took a moment to be alone. He sat in his office in the Nippon Times building and contemplated. Already, before he had left his house to come to his office, he had received Ito's report on Mr. Baines. There was no doubt in the young student's mind. Mr. Baines was not a Swede. Mr. Baines was most certainly a German national. But Ito's ability to handle Germanic languages had never impressed either the trade missions or the Tokuka, the Japanese secret police. The fool possibly had sniffed out nothing to speak of, Mr. Togomi thought to himself. Maladroit enthusiasm, combined with romantic doctrines. Detect, always with suspicion. Anyhow, the conference with Mr. Baines and the elderly individual from the home islands would begin soon, in due course, whatever national Mr. Baines was. And Mr. Togomi liked the man. That was, he decided, conceivably the basic talent of the man highly placed such as himself, to know a good man when he met him. Intuition about people, cut through all ceremony and outward form, penetrate to the heart. The heart, locked within two yin lines of black passion, strangled sometimes, and yet, even then, the light of yang, the flicker at the center. I like him, Mr. Togomi said to himself. German or Swede. I hope the Zerikane helped his headache. Must recall to inquire, first off the bat. His desk intercom buzzed.
No, he said brusquely into it. No discussion. This moment for inner truth. Introversion.
From the tiny speaker, Mr. Ramsey's voice.
Sir, news has just come from the press service below. The Reichschancellor is dead. Martin Bormann.
Ramsey's voice popped off. Silence. Mr. Togomi thought, cancel all business for today. He rose from his desk and paced rapidly back and forth, pressing his hands together. Let me see. Dispatch at once formal note to Reichskonsul. Minor item, subordinate can accomplish. Deep sorrow, etc. All Japan joins with German people in this sad hour. Then, become vitally receptive. Must be in position to receive information from Tokyo instantly. Pressing the intercom button, he said, Mr. Ramsey, be sure we are through to Tokyo. Tell the switchboard girls, be alert. Must not miss communication.
Yes, sir, Mr. Ramsey said.
I will be in my office from now on. Thwart all routine matters. Turn back any and all callers whose business is customary.
Sir?
My hands must be free in case sudden activity is needed.
Yes, sir.
Half an hour later, at 9, a message arrived from the highest-ranking imperial government official on the West Coast, the Japanese ambassador to the Pacific States of America, the Honorable Baron L.B. Kadamakule. The Foreign Office had called an extraordinary session at the embassy building on Sutter Street, and each trade mission was to send a highly placed personage to attend. In this case, it meant Mr. Tagomi himself. There was no time to change clothes. Mr. Tagomi hurried to the express elevator, descended to the ground floor, and a moment later was on his way by mission limousine, a black 1940 Cadillac driven by an experienced, uniformed Chinese chauffeur. At the embassy building, he found other dignitaries' cars parked roundabout, a dozen in all. Highly placed worthies, some of whom he knew, some of whom were strangers to him, could be seen ascending the wide steps of the embassy building, filing on inside. Mr. Tagomi's chauffeur held the door open, and he stepped out quickly, gripping his briefcase. It was empty, because he had no papers to bring, but it was essential to avoid appearance of being mere spectator. He strode up the steps in a manner suggesting a vital role in the happenings, although actually he had not even been told what this meeting would cover. Small knots of personages had gathered, murmured discussions in the lobby. Mr. Tagomi joined several individuals whom he knew, nodding his head and looking, with them, solemn. An embassy employee appeared presently and directed them into a large hall, chairs set up, folding type. All persons filed in, seated themselves silently except for coughing and shuffling. Talk had ceased. Toward the front, a gentleman with handful of papers, making way up to slightly raised table, striped pants, representative from Foreign Office. Bit of confusion, other personages discussing in low tones, heads bowed together.
Sirs,
the Foreign Office person said in loud, commanding voice. All eyes fixed then on him.
As you know, the Reich Chancellor is now confirmed as dead. Official statement from Berlin. This meeting, which will not last long, you will soon be able to go back to your offices, is for purposes of informing you of our evaluation of several contending factions in German political life, who can now be expected to step forth and engage in no-holds-barred disputation for spot evacuated by Herr Bormann. Briefly, the notables. The foremost, Hermann Göring. Bear with familiar details, please. The fat one, so-called due to body, originally courageous air ace in First World War, founded Gestapo and held post in Prussian government of vast power. One of the most ruthless early Nazis, yet later sybaritic excesses gave rise to misguiding picture of amiable wine-tippling disposition, which our government urges you to reject. This man, although said to be unhealthy, possibly even morbidly so in terms of appetites, resembles more the self-gratifying ancient Roman Caesars, whose power grew rather than abated as age progressed. Lurid picture of this person in toga with pet lions, owning immense castle filled with trophies and art objects, is no doubt accurate. Freight trains of stolen valuables made way to his private estates over military needs in wartime. Our evaluation, this man craves enormous power and is capable of obtaining it. Most self-indulgent of all Nazis, and is in sharp contrast to late H. Himmler, who lived in personal want at low salary. Herr Göring, representative of spoils mentality, using power as means of acquiring personal wealth. Primitive mentality, even vulgar, but quite intelligent man, possibly most intelligent of all Nazi chiefs. Object of his drives, self-glorification in ancient emperor fashion. Next, Herr J. Goebbels, suffered polio in youth, originally Catholic, brilliant orator, writer, flexible and fanatic mind, witty, urbane, cosmopolitan, much active with ladies, elegant, educated, highly capable, does much work, almost frenzied managerial drive, is said never to rest, much respected personage, can be charming, but is said to have rabid streak unmatched by other Nazis.
ideological orientation suggesting medieval Jesuitic viewpoint exacerbated by post-romantic Germanic nihilism, considered sole authentic intellectual of the Partei, had ambitions to be playwright in youth, few friends, not liked by subordinates, but nonetheless highly polished product of many best elements in European culture. Not self-gratification is underlying ambition, but power for its use purely. Organizational attitude in classic Prussian state sense. Herr R. Heydrich. The Foreign Office official paused, glanced up and around at them all. Then he resumed. Much younger individual than above, who helped original revolution in 1932. Career man with elite SS. Subordinate of H. Himmler. May have played role in Himmler's not yet fully explained death in 1948. Officially eliminated other contestants within police apparatus such as A. Eichmann, W. Schellenberg et al. This man said to be feared by many Partei people. Responsible for controlling Wehrmacht elements after close of hostilities in famous clash between police and army, which led to reorganization of governmental apparatus. Out of all this, the NSDAP emerging victor. Supported M. Bormann throughout. Product of elite training and yet anterior to so-called SS Castle system. Said to be devoid of effective mentality in traditional sense. Enigmatic in terms of drive. Possibly may be said to have view of society which holds human struggle to be a series of games. Peculiar quasi-scientific detachment found also in certain technological circles. Not party to ideological disputes. Summation? Can be called most modern in mentality. Post-Enlightenment type. Dispensing with so-called necessary illusions such as belief in God, etc. Meaning of this so-called realistic mentality cannot be fathomed by social scientists in Tokyo, so this man must be considered a question mark. However, notice of resemblance to deterioration of affectivity and pathological schizophrenia should be made. Mr. Tagomi felt ill as he listened. Baldur von Schirach, former head of Hitler Youth, considered idealist, personally attractive in appearance, but considered not highly experienced or competent. Sincere believer in goals of Partei, took responsibility for draining Mediterranean and reclaiming of huge areas of farmland. Also mitigated vicious policies of racial extermination in Slavic lands in early 50s. Pled case directly to German people for remnant of Slavic peoples to exist on reservation-like closed regions in heartland area. Called for end of certain forms of mercy killings and medical experimentation, but failed here. Dr. Seiss Inquart, former Austrian Nazi, now in charge of Reich colonial areas, responsible for colonial policies. Possibly most hated man in Reich territory. Said to have instigated most, if not all, repressive measures dealing with conquered peoples. Worked with Rosenberg for ideological victories of most alarming grandiose type, such as attempt to sterilize entire Russian population, remaining after close of hostilities. No facts for certain on this, but considered to be one of several responsible for decision to make Holocaust of African continent, thus creating genocide conditions for Negro population. Possibly closest in temperament to original Führer, A. Hitler. The Foreign Office spokesman ceased his dry, slow recitation. Mr. Tagomi thought, I think I am going mad. I have to get out of here. I am having an attack. My body is throwing up things or spurting them out. I am dying. He scrambled to his feet, pushed down the aisle past other chairs and people. He could hardly see. Get to lavatory. He ran up the aisle. Several heads turned. Saw him. Humiliation. Sick at important meeting. Lost place. He ran on through the open door held by embassy employee. At once the panic ceased. His gaze ceased to swim. He saw objects once more. Stable floor. Walls. Attack of vertigo. Middle ear malfunction, no doubt. He thought, diencephalon, ancient brainstem acting up. Some organic momentary breakdown. Think along reassuring lines. Recall order of world. What to draw on? Religion? He thought, now a gavotte performs sedately. Capital both, you've caught it nicely. This is the style of thing precisely. Small form of recognizable world. Gondoliers, G&S. He shut his eyes, imagined the doily cart company as he had seen them on their tour after the war. The finite, finite world. An embassy employee at his elbow saying, Sir, can I give you assistance? Mr. Tagomi bowed. I am recovered. The other's face, calm, considerate, no derision. They are all laughing at me, possibly?
Mr. Tagomi thought. Down underneath?
There is evil. It's actual, like cement. I can't believe it. I can't stand it. Evil is not a view.
He wandered about the lobby, hearing the traffic on Sutter Street, the Foreign Office spokesman addressing the meeting. All our religion is wrong. What'll I do? He asked himself. He went to the front door of the embassy. An employee opened it, and Mr. Tagomi walked down the steps to the path. The parked cars, his own, chauffeurs standing. It's an ingredient in us, in the world, poured over us, filtering into our bodies, minds, hearts, into the pavement itself. Why? We're blind moles, creeping through the soil, feeling with our snoots. We know nothing. I perceive this. Now I don't know where to go. Screech with fear only. Run away. Pitiful. Laugh at me, he thought, as he saw the chauffeurs regarding him as he walked to his car. Forgot my briefcase. Left it back there by my chair. All eyes on him as he nodded to his chauffeur. Door held open. He crept into his car. Take me to the hospital, he thought. No, take me back to the office. Nippon Times Building, he said aloud. Drive slowly. He watched the city, the cars, stores, tall buildings, now very modern. People, all the men and women, going on their separate businesses. When he reached his office, he instructed Mr. Ramsey to contact one of the other trade missions, the non-ferrous ores mission, and to request that their representative to the Foreign Office meeting contact him on his return. Shortly before noon, the call came through.
Possibly you noticed my distress at meeting, Mr. Tagomi said into the phone. It was no doubt palpable to all, especially my hasty flight.
I saw nothing, the non-ferrous man said. But after the meeting I did not see you, and wondered what had become of you.
You are tactful, Mr. Tagomi said bleakly.
Not at all. I am sure everyone was too wrapped up in the Foreign Office lecture to pay heed to any other consideration. As to what occurred after your departure, did you stay through the rundown of aspirants in the power struggle? That comes first.
I heard to the part about Dr. Seiss Inquart.
Following that, the speaker dilated on the economic situation over there. The home islands take the view that Germany's scheme to reduce the populations of Europe and Northern Asia to the status of slaves, plus murdering all intellectuals, bourgeois elements, patriotic youth, and whatnot, has been an economic catastrophe. Only the formidable technological achievements of German science and industry have saved them. Miracle weapons, so to speak.
Yes,
Mr. Tagomi said. Seated at his desk, holding the phone with one hand, he poured himself a cup of hot tea.
As did their miracle weapons V-1 and V-2 and their jet fighters in the war.
It is a sleight-of-hand business, the non-ferrous oarsman said. Mainly their uses of atomic energy have kept things together, and the diversion of their circus-like rocket travel to Mars and Venus. He pointed out that for all their thrilling import, such traffic has yielded nothing of economic worth.
But they are dramatic, Mr. Tagomi said.
His prognosis was gloomy. He feels that most high-placed Nazis are refusing to face facts vis-à-vis their economic plight. By doing so, they accelerate the tendency toward greater tour-de-force adventures, less predictability, less stability in general. The cycle of manic enthusiasm, then fear, then party solutions of a desperate type. Well, the point he got across was that all this tends to bring the most irresponsible and reckless aspirants to the top. Mr. Tagomi nodded. So we must presume that the worst, rather than the best, choice will be made. The sober and responsible elements will be defeated in the present clash.
Who did he say was the worst? Mr. Tagomi said.
R. Heydrich, Dr. Seiss Inquart, H. Goring, in the Imperial Government's opinion.
And the best?
Possibly B. von Schirach and Dr. Goebbels, but on that he was less explicit. Anything more? He told us that we must have faith in the Emperor and the Cabinet at this time more than ever, that we can look toward the palace with confidence.
Was there a moment of respectful silence?
Yes. Mr. Tagomi thanked the non-ferrous oarsman and rang off. As he sat drinking his tea, the intercom buzzed. Miss Freakian's voice came.
Sir, you had wanted to send a message to the German consul?
A pause.
Did you wish to dictate it to me at this time?
That is so, Mr. Tagomi realized. I had forgotten.
Come into the office, he said.
Presently she entered, smiling at him hopefully.
"You are feeling better, sir?"
"Yes. An injection of vitamins has helped," he considered. "Recall to me. What is the German consul's name?"
"I have that, sir. Freiherr Hugo Reiss."
"Mein Herr," Mr. Tagomi began, "shocking news has arrived that your leader, Herr Martin Bormann, has succumbed. Tears rise to my eyes as I write these words. When I recall the bold deeds perpetrated by Herr Bormann in securing the salvation of the German people from her enemies both at home and abroad, as well as the soul-shaking measures of sternness meted out to the shirkers and traitors who would betray all mankind's vision of the cosmos, into which now the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Nordic races have after eons plunged in their—" He stopped. There was no way to finish. Miss Afrikian stopped the tape recorder, waiting. "These are great times," he said.
"Should I record that, sir? Is that the message?"
Uncertainly, she started up her machine.
"I was addressing you," Mr. Tagomi said.
She smiled.
"Play my utterances back," Mr. Tagomi said.
The tape transport spun. Then he heard his voice, tiny and metallic, issuing from the 2-inch speaker. "Perpetrated by Herr Bormann in his securing the salvation—" He listened to the insect-like squeak as it rambled on. Cortical flappings and scrapings, he thought.
"I have the conclusion," he said, when the transport ceased turning. "Determination to exalt and immolate themselves, and so obtain a niche in history from which no life form can cast them, no matter what may transpire." He paused.
"We are all insects," he said to Miss Afrikian, "groping toward something terrible or divine. Do you not agree?" He bowed. Miss Afrikian, seated with her tape recorder, made a slight bow back. "Send that," he told her. "Sign it, etc. Work the sentences if you wish, so that they will mean something." As she started from the office, he added, "Or so that they mean nothing, whichever you prefer." As she opened the office door, she glanced at him curiously. After she had left, he began work on routine matters of the day, but almost at once Mr. Ramsey was on the intercom.
"Sir, Mr. Baines is calling."
"Good," Mr. Tagomi thought. "Now we can begin important discussion." "Put him on," he said, picking up the phone. "Mr. Tagomi," Mr. Bain's voice came.
"Good afternoon. Due to news of Chancellor Bormann's death, I was unexpectedly out of my office this morning. However—"
"Did Mr. Yatari get in touch with you?"
"Not yet," Mr. Tagomi said.
"Did you tell your staff to keep an eye open for him?" Mr. Bain said. He sounded agitated.
"Yes," Mr. Tagomi said. "They will usher him in directly he arrives."
He made a mental note to tell Mr. Ramsey. As yet he had not gotten around to it. "Are we not to begin discussions then until the old gentleman puts in his appearance?" He felt dismay.
"Sir," he began, "I am anxious to begin. Are you about to present your injection molds to us? Although we have been in confusion today—"
"There has been a change," Mr. Bain said. "We'll wait for Mr. Yatabi. You're sure he hasn't arrived? I want you to give me your word that you'll notify me as soon as he calls you. Please exert yourself, Mr. Tagomi." Mr. Bain's voice sounded strained, jerky.
"I give you my word."
Now he, too, felt agitation. The Bormann death, that had caused the change.
"Meanwhile," he said rapidly, "I would enjoy your company, perhaps at lunch today. I not having had opportunity to have my lunch yet."
Improvising, he continued,
"Although we will wait on specifics, perhaps we could ruminate on general world conditions. In particular—"
"No," Mr. Bain said.
"No?"
Mr. Tagomi thought.
"Sir," he said, "I am not well today. I had a grievous incident. It was my hope to confide it to you."
"I'm sorry," Mr. Bain said. "I'll ring you back later." The phone clicked. He had abruptly hung up. I offended him, Mr. Tagomi thought. He must have gathered correctly that I tardily failed to inform my staff about the old gentleman. But it is a trifle. He pressed the intercom button and said,
"Mr. Ramsey, please come into my office."
I can correct that immediately. More is involved, he decided. The Borman death had shaken him. A trifle, and yet indicative of my foolish and feckless attitude, Mr. Tagomi felt guilt. This is not a good day. I should have consulted the oracle, discovered what moment it is. I have drifted far from the Tao, that is obvious. Which of the 64 hexagrams, he wondered, am I laboring under? Opening his desk drawer, he brought out the I Ching and laid the two volumes on the desk. So much to ask the sages, so many questions inside me which I can barely articulate. When Mr. Ramsey entered the office, he had already obtained the hexagram. Look, Mr. Ramsey. He showed him the book. The hexagram was 47. Oppression. Exhaustion.
A bad omen, generally, Mr. Ramsey said. What is your question, sir, if I'm not offending you to ask?
I inquired as to the moment, Mr. Tagomi said. The moment for us all. No moving lines. A static hexagram. He shut the book. At 3 o'clock that afternoon, Frank Frink, still waiting with his business partner for Wyndham Matheson's decision about the money, decided to consult the oracle. How are things going to turn out? He asked, and threw the coins. The hexagram was 47. He obtained one moving line, 9 in the 5th place. His nose and feet are cut off. Oppression at the hands of the man with the purple knee bands. Joy comes softly. It furthers one to make offerings and libations. For a long time, at least half an hour, he studied the line and the material connected with it, trying to figure out what it might mean. The hexagram, and especially the moving line, disturbed him. At last he concluded reluctantly that the money would not be forthcoming.
You rely on that thing too much, Ed McCarthy said.
At 4 o'clock, a messenger from WM Corporation appeared and handed Frink and McCarthy a manila envelope. When they opened it, they found inside a certified check for $2,000.
So you were wrong, McCarthy said.
Frink thought, then the oracle must refer to some future consequence of this. That is the trouble. Later on, when it has happened, you can look back and see exactly what it meant. But now...
We can start setting up the shop, McCarthy said.
Today? Right now? He felt weary.
Why not? We've got our orders made out. All we have to do is stick them in the mail. The sooner the better. And the stuff we can get locally, we'll pick up ourselves.
Putting on his jacket, Ed moved to the door of Frink's room. They had talked Frink's landlord into renting them the basement of the building. Now it was used for storage. Once the cartons were out, they could build their bench, put in wiring, lights, begin to mount their motors and belts. They had drawn up sketches, specifications, parts lists. So they had actually already begun. We're in business, Frank Frink realized. They had even agreed on a name. Ed Frank Custom Jewelers.
The most I can see today, he said, is buying the wood for the bench, and maybe electrical parts, but no jewelry supplies.
They went, then, to a lumber supply yard in South San Francisco. By the end of an hour, they had their wood.
What's bothering you?
Ed McCarthy said as they entered a hardware store that dealt on a wholesale basis.
The money. It gets me down to finance things that way.
Old WM understands, McCarthy said.
I know, Frink thought. That's why it gets me down. We have entered the world. We're like him. Is that a pleasant thought?
Don't look back, McCarthy said. Look ahead, to the business.
I am looking ahead, Frink thought. He thought of the hexagram. What offerings and libations can I make, and to whom?